Welcome, everyone. Today we are going to focus most of our attention on the Blakely case. For those of you who are of counsel to suspected cheaters, I want to tell you that Senate Bill 528 has no legs whatsoever, and it's a wonderful vehicle to do some other interesting things. So if all the cheating constituency can leave the room at this point, that would be great. Just kidding. We want you all here for this discussion. So we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 528. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 528 is in your packet. This bill, as described in the Dash 2 amendment, is the attempt to bring Oregon statutes in compliance with Blakely versus Washington and with the principles of Blakely as applied in State versus Dilts, U.S. Supreme Court and Oregon Supreme Court cases, respectively. The measure deals with the process by which departure sentences, that is to say sentences beyond the presumptive sentencing guideline range, can be achieved. The amendment conceives of two sorts of enhancement facts. One set of facts relates to the offense. One set of enhancement facts relates to the defendant. It requires the state to give notice to the defendant if the state intends to rely on either type of enhancement fact to obtain a departure sentence beyond the guideline maximum. And it envisions that the offense-related enhancement facts would be tried to the jury along with the elements of the offense in the guilt-innocence phase of the trial. It envisions the defendant-related facts to be tried to the jury, unless waived, in the sentencing phase of the trial. Also included in this amendment to Senate Bill 528 is the provision regarding dangerous offenders and sexually violent dangerous offenders. Those topics were covered in Senate Bills 255 and 256, respectively, which are on our agenda for work session. At the time we had that work session, the committee indicated the desire to roll those two issues into this main bill, since they cover overlapping issues, that is, the findings of facts that may enhance a sentence beyond the presumptive range. The way this measure is written, the final point is that the way this measure is written, this new procedure would apply to criminal proceedings that are currently pending or that but that have not reached the point of sentencing yet, as well as any criminal cases after the effective date. There is an emergency clause, and there's a provision by which the procedure would apply to remanded cases, that is, cases that were sentenced, gone up to the Court of Appeals, error in the sentencing is found, and are being sent back to the Court of Appeals for resentencing.
Thank you for that description, Counsel. This is this came out of as the Counsel said, a U.S. Supreme Court decision pertaining to the Washington State guidelines, and it basically held that if a judge uses aggravating factors to do what they call an upward departure of a sentence, which is enhancing a sentence beyond that as applied under the Oregon sentencing guidelines, that's an unconstitutional denial of due process, that those anything that can enhance a sentence has to be determined beyond a reasonable doubt by a jury. So that little description is made possible because of my participation in the Blakely Work Group, which is the source of the Dash 2 amendments. So we will start with the public testimony. Here we have Judge Marcus. Okay. Judge Marcus, I think we're going to have the three members of the work group who attended the big conference that we all went to on Blakely in Denver start us off to introduce the product of the work group. So that'd be Chuck French, Jennifer Lloyd, and Bob Holman. Okay. And if there's a fourth chair, we might ask Jean Ann Quinn to come up as well from the courts. Leave that to your discretion. Thank you, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Sarah Burdick and members of the committee, thank you for having us here today. I'm Jennifer Lloyd. I work for the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here to speak both in my role as part of the work group that the governor put together to work on the Blakely issue, and also for the Attorney General. Bob Holman is here from the Lane County Public Defender's Office, and he also participated in the work group and is here to speak on behalf of his organization. Chuck French is here from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office and will be speaking in both capacities as well. And Jean Ann Quinn is with the Judicial Department, and I apologize, I don't know was involved in the work group, but I'm not sure exactly what capacity she is here in.
And I can talk to that when it's
fine. Okay, that's fine. Thank you. As the committee knows, I believe this work group was set up by the governor. It included members of the defense bar, the prosecution, the attorney general's office, judges, the judicial department, in recognition of the fact that the Blakely decision threw a monkey wrench into everything that we thought we were doing at sentencing. We recognized that if there were not a legislative fix, we were all going to be in trouble. We came up with what we believe is a broad fix that works within the existing sentencing guidelines and other statutes relating to sentencing, some of which will be are the subject of other bills. But this is a broad attempt to set up a structure by which sentencing factors, or what we've called in the bill enhancement factors, can be submitted to a jury in order to be considered, in order to be used to enhance a sentence. We have all just received this draft of Senate Bill 528-2 within the last 18 hours or so. We've identified some technical problems. We expect that there may be some more, and I'm not sure that the committee wants to hear about that today. I'll, of course, leave that to the discretion of the chair. What I did prepare, however, is a summary of what we believe the key provisions of at least the first part of this bill, will do, and I believe everyone has a copy. Simply put, what this bill does is define very broadly enhancement factors that must be submitted to a jury in order to enhance a sentence. Subsection 2 of the bill requires the state to give notice either by alleging aggravating facts in the charging instrument or by giving notice separately to the defense. The bill sets up a distinction between types of aggravating factors in subsections 3 and 4. The default position is that factors that relate to the offense, things like the harm to the victim, the damage done in, say, a criminal mischief case, those factors will be submitted to the jury in the trial phase of the proceeding. The other factors that relate to the particular qualities of the offender will be submitted in a separate proceeding, or will be either to a judge or to a jury. I'm sorry, I'm having some dry mouth trouble. thank you.
We'll take care of that quickly. Thank you, Senator.
Full service.
They teach them well in Texas.
Well, that makes it less painful for all of us. Thank you. So I'm working from the summary here, and as I said, subsection 3 provides that factors that relate to the offense as opposed to the particular qualities of the offender will be submitted during the trial phase. Other factors, which usually are far more prejudicial to the defendant, like persistent involvement in other offenses, lack of remorse, those types of factors will be submitted in a separate proceeding, as I said, either to a jury or to a judge if the defendant waives the right to jury. Subsection 5 simply provides that evidence that was offered in an earlier proceeding may be considered in the separate proceeding. This is considered to be a continuation of the original proceeding. Number 6 sets forth what I called 4 major points because they're sort of discrete points. The first is just that if the enhancement fact is tried to the jury, the judge must actually ask the jury the appropriate questions. The second is that the state has the burden of proving aggravating facts beyond a reasonable doubt. The third is that if the matter is tried to the jury, at least 10 jurors shall agree to the existence of the enhancement fact. And then finally, if the jury finds that a fact exists, the court cannot go back and determine on its own whether that fact truly exists. However, what we wanted to make clear, what we think is the law now, and what we wanted to make express in the statute is that even if the jury makes a finding that a particular fact exists, for example, that the offender has engaged in persistent involvement in similar other offenses, that the judge still has the ultimate authority to decide whether to impose an enhanced sentence based on that finding. And then finally, subsection 7 of the bill amends the evidence code to make sure that it is clear that it that the evidence code does apply to these proceedings.
Yeah, I'm up in revenue and I'll check in with anything to tell
here. I don't know if your water runs low.
No, I'm fine. Thank you for the help.
I think any one of us is prepared to discuss, answer any questions, discuss any aspects of the bill that aren't clear either from the bill itself or from the summary. What I do need to say first on behalf of Bradbury, who is the president of the, he's the legislative contact for the Oregon District Attorneys Association. They do not oppose this bill. They have worked within the work group quite effectively and constructively. However, because they have 36 members who are independently elected, there is some disagreement among the members, and so they're not prepared to fully support or unqualifiedly support the bill. However, they have, I'm told, withdrawn a competing bill that would make the guidelines advisory.
And that has taken place. I know that was kind of out there, but that has been officially withdrawn.
Okay, thank you.
I mean, are you saying that?
I'm saying that's my understanding, that's the message that I got through Brad, but I don't know exactly how that's been done. Okay. And as I stated before, the Attorney General is in favor of this bill, believes that it keeps most existing law in place and is the most flexible solution to the Blakely problem.
Thank you. You had asked earlier, and I'll leave this to your discretion whether you want to have the others talk first, but you'd asked it to be left to my discretion whether we wanted to talk about some of the technical issues, and I do today. I mean, I think it would be stunning to the point of unbelievable if we could actually get everything right when we're making groundbreaking law here the first time. So the more we can get on the record as to what problems are and what needs to be fixed, the better.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think what might make more sense is for me to yield to any one of these other people, and then we can all raise the miscellaneous concerns that have come up.
You want to go first?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Chuck French. I'm with the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. And as you know, I've been involved from the outset in the work group. In fact, went to Denver with members, with yourself, Senator Burdick, and some of the other members here. In crafting this bill, and I think I've used the term correctly, crafting this bill, because there is a lot of ground to cover, I think that our work group approached this with the idea of maintaining, as a basic concept, maintaining the sentencing guidelines concept, in that we did not want to have the Blakely bill result in the ending of legislation and sentencing guideline structure that would then lead to disparate sentences across the state. I think as a policy matter, we concluded it's a good idea to have sentencing guidelines and retain them in some way. One of the other things we wanted to do was to retain a predictable outcome as far as sentencing is concerned. I know that financial issues with the Department of Corrections are always a matter to be considered, and we wanted to craft a bill that would retain those type of predictable patterns of sentencing across the state, and doing that with the flexibility to allow prosecutors to charge people and to charge sentencing enhancements and yet retain due process rights of defendants. And I really do believe that we have achieved that here. We found over the past months that these cases have been relatively few in the broad spectrum of criminal prosecutions. Most cases, of course, are resolved by pleas. And the ones that aren't resolved by pleas, very few of them would choose and have chosen to have sentencing done by a jury or enhancement factors found by a jury. So there's a relatively small number of cases that will ultimately be affected by this, and we felt that with such a small number of cases that ultimately go through the system, we could retain the sentencing guideline concept, and I think the work group has done that. I should add that our county, in Multnomah County, our office has instituted a very similar policy from the outset of the Blakely decision, and we've had relatively few cases, and I want to say less than 10 cases in our county where we've actually had judges do a sentencing enhancement jury finding. So we think that this bill is the best way to retain the sentencing guidelines and yet address all the issues that Ms. Lloyd has just discussed with the court. There are, I'm aware, and Mr. O'Leary is aware too, because we've talked about this just briefly before this, there are some technical issues involved here. Happy to discuss them. But from an overall perspective, from the point of view of the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, this is a bill that I think is a very good product of a lot of different people from different sections of the criminal justice community have gotten together and have put this together in a way that I think not only complies with the Blakely decision, but also follows the basic policy instincts that have existed in this state for the last 15 or more years with the sentencing guidelines. So with that, I'll turn it over to Bob or anyone else.
Before you do, I just had a question. You mentioned that there are about 10 cases that have come over the transom since the Blakely case where this has been a fact, where upward departures have been a factor. How are you handling them in Multnomah County? And to your knowledge, how are other DAs handling these types of cases, DAs and courts handling these types of cases?
Well, that's an interesting question because, one of the things the work group has done is we've managed to collect anecdotal data from around the state each time we've met as to how judges and prosecutors are handling this. The way we handle it in Multnomah County up to now is we have initially we felt we might need to put put these enhancement factors in an indictment after certain Court of Appeals decisions, I think in November or December, let us believe we didn't have to. So essentially, we have been notifying defendants of potential aggravating factors just by sending them a letter saying we intend to prove these factors against you at trial if you choose to go to trial. That's where we stand right now. Again, most...
Excuse me for interrupting. Are those just offense-related factors?
We have notified them of offense-related factors and offender-related factors also. We feel that's probably our obligation, and that would be included in the bill also, that offense-related factors would have to be identified, notification provided to the defense in a reasonable period of time, and also offender-related factors would, too.
But take up the offender-related factors in the trial itself, or is there a separate proceeding?
Well, my experience with this has been we've had so few of these cases that it's hard to say what the standard practice has been. Essentially, I think many of these offense-related factors are factors which are proved within the crime itself. For instance, the use of a gun. So those are things that are going to be heard and have been heard in a trial itself during the guilt phase of the trial. So that's really not a substantial issue, I think, in our county, because in many of the in the few instances I can think of where this has occurred and the jury has made a finding, the finding has been well within the elements of the crime. For instance, the one I'm using was the use of a gun. Mm-hmm. In a robbery, for instance, if a gun were used or a weapon were used, that might be an enhancement factor, but it's also an element of the crime. And so those are proved together.
Those are proved together, but if you have another, for example, persistent involvement, things that could be prejudicial in the course of a trial on a particular offense, how do you handle those, the offender-related ones?
Madam Chair, those are offender-related, and they like persistent involvement in criminal conduct, and those will be heard afterwards in a bifurcated mm-hmm. proceeding. Now, of course, there's...
So you just keep the jury there? Is that
jury? In a few instances where that's happened, the same jury has been used mm-hmm. to hear those facts. Now, there has been an issue that's arisen in the last... I mean, I won't say it's just arisen. It was something that Mr. Holman and the defense bar anticipated from the outset, that maybe there's not a statutory mechanism to allow these type of factors to go to a jury. And so that's been something we've dealt with from the outset. However, my understanding is there, as courts have read the law and have formed their opinions about this, more courts have concluded that maybe there is no statutory mechanism for these to go to the jury, which is why we need this type of legislation to clarify that. Many judges don't accept that. Some judges have accepted that. And so there are a few judges on the Multnomah County bench who have concluded that we can't have any sentencing proceedings on enhancement factors because we have no legislation to allow it. That's why it's critical, I think, to provide this type of guidance for the court so that there would be, you know, those type of... we can point to a law and say, here's the law that allows us to have a bifurcated proceeding.
Right. Senator Pruszynski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to clarify, what I just heard is that offender factors are going to be bifurcated out from the determination of guilt. Once the guilt has been done, which could have the offense factors, mm-hmm. which you'd have to do plead and prove to get to that point, that element, then we're going to have that. And potentially, it sounds like here in Oregon, we don't have what some states already have, is the mechanism for statutorily allowing for those factors that would be offender factors to be brought before the jury and that separate second proceeding.
Right. That's, we would argue that we do have mechanisms that are appropriate, but there has been an argument on the other side, which has been accepted by some, that we don't have those. The only thing I would, the only thing you said there that I would disagree with, Senator, is that mm-hmm. In fact, this legislation doesn't require us to plead those. It only requires us to provide notice within a due process, constitutional due process period of time prior to the actual trial. So the plead and prove issue was one which has been clarified by some court decisions, but essentially the rest of it, I mean, you have accurately portrayed the way the picture looks right now.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, I think Texas actually does have that bifurcated process where the jury would sit in deliberation as to the on the sentence, and you'd bring out the other factors as to this is a felon that's been convicted of prior consistent, whatever those aggravating factors could be at that point. And I appreciate that maybe it's not clear, but what we want to do is clarify it so everyone knows. And I know we're going to hear from Judge Marcus too, and give us his perspective from the bench, just to make sure that everyone knows this is a procedure based on the Blakely case, that how we're going to proceed from this day forward.
Right, and Madam Chair and Senator Brzezanski, the Texas thing is a good example. There, a jury, a defendant is authorized to allow any felony sentencing to go in front of a jury, and the history of that and the practice there is that, as we're finding in our state here, most defendants waive that right. They would prefer to have judges sentence them than juries. And we found as a practical matter that's been the case here, and we just need a mechanism to allow them to do that, which is what this is.
Thank you. Who's next? Mr. Holman.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I'm Bob Holman. I represent Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association and was also the representative of that group on the Blakely Work Group. First of all, I'd like to commend the work of the group. I think that we all got together, spent a lot of time, and came up with some good consensus for the most part. On behalf of the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, I still need to say that I think that the Kansas plan might be cleaner because it would allow all the enhancement factors to be presented to the jury. But I think that the plan that the Blakely Work Group has come up with is an adequate plan, and it would have the support of most members of the defense community as well.
Mr. Holman, just for the record, could you just give a brief description of the Kansas plan?
What Kansas did is it anticipated the Blakely decision, and members of the group, correct me if I'm stray on this, and Kansas adopted some legislation that provided for a bifurcated jury hearing trial, so to speak, and they had proceeded to trial just as a regular trial would be, and then enhancement factors were submitted to the jury following a verdict if the verdict was guilty. And that jury, I believe, is the same jury, and basically came back with a verdict on the enhancement factors. And then the judge would use that verdict to determine whether to impose a departure sentence.
And I should know this because I was there when it was presented, but I can't remember, was it offender-related and offense-related that all went to this bifurcated?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's my understanding.
In the same proceeding?
In the second jury proceeding,
right.
Yes.
Correct. Okay, thank you for that clarification.
Yes. That said, the other concern of the defense community is the list of aggravating or enhancement factors. I think that there is a purported list of about 20 factors that have been approved by either administrative agency or appellate decisions. And what I want to emphasize is a concern that prejudicial matter could still be presented to the trial or the guilt phase jury that wouldn't be otherwise admissible at present. And that is the concern that we have as the defense community, and would caution this body to adopt legislation that would try to keep that from happening.
Okay. And I think that would have to be done because it wouldn't pass muster if that ended up being the effect.
Well, there's due process problems if the defendant doesn't receive a fair trial because prejudicial information gets presented to the jury that is too prejudicial and not that probative.
Okay. Thank you. Is that it?
That's what I have to say.
Okay, great. Did you want to comment as well?
Thank you. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Jeanne Quinn, and I am a senior criminal law analyst and lawyer for the Oregon Judicial Department. I also was involved in the work group and participated with Circuit Judges Richard Barron and Julie Franz. Judge Barron is from Coos County, and Judge Franz is from Multnomah County. And while the Judicial Department doesn't feel it's particularly appropriate for us to comment on the policy issues presented by the bill, we were asked to help in the work group to determine the viability of different options that were presented and kind of go through the process with everybody, and did that and feel that the option that's reflected in this work group draft is certainly a viable option, and for cases that are coming up and also for how to handle cases that may be determined to have Blakely related issues in the future. There are still issues out there that the courts are considering, for example, consecutive sentences and whether or not Blakely will apply there, and this bill is written broadly enough to potentially capture that. I might add that when we talk about the relatively few number of cases, that is still one of the open questions, is the consecutive sentence question. The other thing, Senator Burdick, I wanted to mention using the same jury, and that absolutely is the case, and that's what is intended. The bill is also written to cover cases that are being remanded back to the circuit courts for resentencing because of Blakely, and in those cases we would need to impanel a new jury because the jury has obviously been discharged.
And do you have any sense of how many cases are in that category of things?
We don't. We don't have any way of really knowing that they're happening, you know, regularly. So we're working on that and are trying to monitor the situation, and we'll definitely be coming back to the legislature as we get more information.
Great. Appreciate it.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I have one more anecdotal suggestion, and that was to answer your question about what jurors or what judges have been doing in different counties. In Lane County, I don't believe there may have been one case that was sent to a sentencing jury, and I think rather humorously the court found that it didn't have the statutory authority to take the verdict after it sent the matter to the jury. But that's the only case I'm aware of that's gone to a jury.
They just framed it and put it in the courthouse, and
yeah,
that was
it.
The verdict. Huh?
Yeah.
Okay. Appreciate that. Thank you. All right, well, why don't we Ms. French, did you have another comment?
Yes, Chair Burdick and members of the committee, I think you wanted to address some of the technical issues
yes.
at this point, and is this the time to do that?
Can I point out that the dash 3 has been passed out?
Yeah, we actually, hot off the press, and don't anybody feel compelled to make a rush for these, but we just got a dash 3 amendment that did address some of the technical issues that our council found, and so I'll let Joe O'Leary describe those in summary, but don't feel like you have to dash because obviously this is going to be a continuing conversation.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The briefest of summary would be that Section 5 of the dash 3, which appears on page 3 of the bill, yes, thank you. Makes a clarification that was not in the dash 2. And that clarification is that in a situation where the defendant waives the right to a jury trial on the issue of guilt or innocence, that is to say, not as to enhancement factors, but rather to the elements of the criminal offense, that by virtue of that waiver, the defendant is also waiving the right to have a jury consider any offense-related factor enhancement factors or any defendant-related enhancement factors. The concept that we discussed in the work group, at least the last meeting of the work group, was...
Excuse me for interrupting.
Yes.
That would be line 14 on page 3 of the dash 3. I see you got your hands on those. That's where that is laid out.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Sorry for the interruption.
So the concept that Mr. French actually was an advocate of at our last work group meeting when we were discussing this somewhat complex, I would say a somewhat difficult, an easy issue to talk about, but a more difficult issue to reduce to writing was how does one treat a waiver of the right to jury? And the intent of the work group, and I believe as now reflected in the dash three, was that if the defendant waived the right to jury as to the elements of the offense up front at the beginning of the trial, then that was a waiver as to the offense-related enhancement facts and the defendant-related enhancement facts. And section three and section four deal with the waiver issue as to when the defendant waives the enhancement-related facts, that's section 3, which it says that the defendant can still have a jury trial on the elements of the crime, but may waive the enhancement facts and let the judge decide those enhancement facts in the sentencing phase. And then in section 4, it discusses the waiver as to the defendant-related enhancement facts, which is to say that the defendant may have a jury trial on the elements of the offense, may decide to have a jury trial as to the enhancement as to the offense-related enhancement facts, but may waive jury as to the defendant-related enhancement facts, and in which case those get tried to the court in the sentencing phase. It's a lot of words, and I'm almost tripping myself up in describing them. Hopefully that we've gotten that concept down to writing, and I think in the next few days, maybe as many eyes look over the writing, we will either fine-tune it or not, hopefully.
So basically, by waiving the right to a jury trial, as I understand it, you're also waiving the right to a jury trial on the enhancement facts.
Senator Burdick, the tricky thing is that as we have always talked about waiving the right to a jury trial, what we've meant is waiving the right to a jury trial on the elements of the offense. Mm-hmm. So to the extent that that's what we mean when we say you're waiving the right to a jury trial, what we mean is if you're waiving the right to a jury trial as to the elements of the offense, then you're waiving the right to a jury trial as to the offense-related enhancements and the defendant-related enhancements.
But if you take a jury trial, you can waive the right to a jury trial on either the offender or the offense-related.
That's correct.
One or both.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
We almost need to go through a trial. Maybe we should have a mock trial.
We've got a judge.
We do. We can do it.
We've got a bunch of marginal characters
lawyers
up here at the dais here, so we could probably put on a trial.
Heaven forbid.
Thank you very much. Okay, so that's one bunch of technical things. Mr. French, did you have more?
Yes, Madam Chair, just one other thing that was not real clear to me. Again, we just had a chance to look at the drafts here, and I had a chance to talk to Ms. Lloyd a little earlier about it, and that would be in Section 20 of the new, of the Dash 3 Amendment, Section 21, what this is applicable to. And the intent here of the work group, if I can kind of paraphrase it, the intent was to make sure that this legislation applied to not only current actions which are commenced now, but actions in the past. My only concern is with subsection 3. It says a case that's been remanded to a trial court for that this new act would apply to any case that has been remanded to a trial court for resentencing for which a new sentence has not been imposed prior to the effective date of this 2005 act. My concern is that there may be cases which have been remanded to the trial court for other purposes, not just for resentencing, but the resentencing is required. In short, if you had a case that's been reversed on some other technical ground, an evidentiary issue in the trial, for instance, the case has been reversed, and then it's remanded to the trial court for a new trial, for instance, we want to make sure, at least from my standpoint, we'd want to make sure that the new sentencing procedures would apply to that case and that we wouldn't be stuck with a situation where the court feels obliged to not allow any enhancement factors because there's no applicable statutory method to do so. So I don't know how we change that.
I think that should be fairly easy.
What? Yes.
I don't know if maybe I'm reading too much into it or not, but we wanted to make sure that that's part of it too, because there will be other cases, and I'm sure, you know, just reading the advance sheets, there have been a number of cases over the past 6 or 8 months which have been reversed on completely different grounds.
And
we would want the new sentencing procedure to apply.
It's just a question to clarify. So what you're saying is that there may be a remand for a substantive issue which results in a new trial, mm-hmm. and if there's a conviction after the new trial, a new mm-hmm. sentencing, mm-hmm. and the way the term sentencing, resentencing maybe in line 6, suggests that it's limited to only those cases that are remanded for resentencing.
I mean, the implication would be any case that's been returned for any new trial is also going to be returned for a resentencing, but my guess is it could be clearer.
I see your point, though, and I think you could probably solve it just by taking out those words for resentencing, because you're talking about a remand for any reason.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you take out those two words on line 6 for resentencing, you'd say a case that has been remanded to a trial court for which a new sentence has not been imposed prior to the effective date, or you could even take away the word new, for which a sentence has not been imposed prior to the effective date of this 2000 Act.
Well, I just think that it might, and again, I haven't thought this out because I've just seen the draft, it might be best to say a case that's been remanded to the trial court for a new trial or resentencing, mm-hmm. period, might be the clearest way to mm-hmm. do that.
Okay, well, I think it's easy to find the words to... This is probably one of the easier ones we're going to get, because we know what we want to do, and it seems pretty straightforward. So if you're talking about a remand, would all the remands fall into the category of either new trial or resentencing?
Well, if I may interject, because I wanted Chair Burdick and members of the committee, I do appellate work, and one of the concerns that I had when Chuck made that suggestion about new trial, we have a lot of cases that are remanded for limited hearings to determine certain facts, whether a waiver of a jury trial was voluntary. I can imagine other remands in light of this new procedure that might relate to some choice that the defendant made relating to the sentencing. We have remands from the post-conviction courts, from the appellate courts, and from federal habeas corpus, federal courts, who are granting relief. And so I would suggest that if we kept it as broad as possible, that would probably serve the purposes that Mr. French is talking about.
Because
I'm sorry.
I apologize.
Anytime you're in the position of imposing a sentence, whether it's you're sticking with the old one or changing it in some way, you're affected by Blakely. At any point,
right.
So perhaps it's a good thing we have appellate lawyers here to tell us because that hadn't occurred to me. Perhaps it's any remand that will result in a resentencing or something along those lines would cover it more.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Then yes, I can see immediately how just limiting it to new trial or resentencing would produce problems.
Okay, and in case it had been remanded to a trial court that would result in a resentencing, that concept. Okay, we got some good thumbs up on that one. So we'll work on that in our next round. Okay, other technical issues?
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, relating to the remand issue, one of the concerns that I've had that I haven't had a chance to articulate to the committee is in Section 2 of the bill, Section 2, subsection 2, that allows the prosecution to give notice within a reasonable time of an intent to rely on aggravating factors or enhancement factors. My concern is if we have these cases coming back for a remand that were originally charged and proceeded with, the case was concluded before we even had the Blakely decision, we may have cases going back for remand where the prosecution has no opportunity to give notice within a reasonable time after filing the accusatory instrument because the accusatory instrument would have been filed years before. And so I know that the committee battled a bit about this reasonable time issue and whether we should pick a time frame or whether reasonable time was fine and whether it should relate to the time of the filing of the charging instrument as opposed to the time of trial. But one way to fix that problem would be to say, to change this focus from the time of the filing of the accusatory instrument to the time of the trial, so some or the new proceeding on remand. So instead of it being within a reasonable time after filing the accusatory instrument, it would be within a reasonable time before trial or sentencing or something like that. I certainly can't speak for the committee on that because it was a contentious issue, but I think that that language does need to be clarified in order to allow the prosecution to use this new procedure on remand in a case that was originally handled before Blakely.
Yeah, that's a good suggestion, but I do wonder how that would affect plea bargains, you know, because if you're talking about after the accusatory instrument, but within a plea proceeding, you know, the notice might actually be part of a plea negotiation. So if you're talking about, I don't know whether trials are always set before you do that. Counsel points out there's a limited number of cases on remand, so maybe that would be another way of looking at it. Anyway, did you have a comment on that, Mr. French, on the plea?
I just to reiterate, Madam Chair and members of the committee, that my recollection of how this worked its way through the work group was there was some dispute about whether we should tag it from the time of the initial charging instrument or from the trial. The way Kansas handled this was they said 30 days from the time of trial in their legislation, but there also was a problem because some cases go to trial fast enough, so 30 days would mean the prosecution would have to notify you before you're even charged, you know. That probably isn't the case in the state of Oregon, except for some misdemeanor matters that may go to trial quickly, although I really don't know what the docketing schedule in some of the other counties are. Our docketing schedule on misdemeanor and felonies are, I think, 47 days, 43 for misdemeanors, something like that, 47 days for first trial setting. So it makes it a little bit difficult sometimes to know, you know, what all your factors are before that and even get them done 30 days prior to trial. So I think what we settled upon was this, but I don't think anyone was considering the issue of remand cases. So I don't know if we can word something that would allow a reasonable time after the filing of the accusatory instrument or the remand from a higher appellate court. Maybe that would solve all the problems, but what Ms. Roy brought up really wasn't addressed by the committee, and it is a potential problem for cases on remand.
We have somebody in the audience with strong opinions who's going to testify here pretty soon, so maybe that'll give us some insight. That issue has been noted. Are there other issues that you had?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I do have a couple more. The key one is in the definition in Section 1, Subsection 2, the definition of enhancement fact. This is one that we were very satisfied with, and there wasn't much dispute once we found this language until I started looking at it after our last meeting. My concern is that currently we have enhancement fact means a fact that is constitutionally required to be found by a jury in order to increase the sentence that may be imposed upon conviction of a crime. The problem is that the question of what is constitutionally required is the hottest issue that any of us is dealing with in the trial courts, appellate courts, anywhere else right now. We don't know what is constitutionally required. At least as far as many factors are concerned. We know that departure factors are under Blakely constitutionally required to be submitted to a jury. But as I'm sure the committee knows, there are many other issues that we aren't entirely sure on. Restitution, what are some of the other factors?
Consecutive
sentences, thank you. Credit for time served, or earned time credits, those types of things. Prior convictions, criminal history. There are numerous issues that aren't resolved and won't be resolved probably for the next several years. And so this definition, I believe, needs to be broadened somehow. And one suggestion would be to say that enhancement fact means a fact that is constitutionally required by the jury or that the prosecution seeks to use or rely on in order to increase the sentence that may be imposed. I know that there may be other people who have even better suggestions, but I do believe that that language needs to be broadened because it simply begs the question of what is constitutionally required.
Okay. Chair Burdick, could I address that, members of the committee? I think the reason for keeping it as broad is to keep it as flexible as we possibly can so that we don't have to have separate definitional sections for consecutive, concurrent types of sentences and the like. I would have some concern on language that would allow the prosecutor to open the door and file all sorts of enhancement factors without some limitations. So I think that was the committee's concern as well.
May I address the committee, Chair Burdick, and members of the committee? The reason for this, and again, these are things that we've just seen the draft a few days ago, and they're just beginning to emerge, but I think the reason for this is to prevent a lot of cases being reversed on appeal. And the reason, and the way that might happen is where what is constitutional now may not be constitutional when the Supreme Court of the United States finally decides another factor. And so we could proceed now with defining an enhancement fact as a fact that is constitutionally required to be found by the jury in order to increase the sentence that may be imposed. We could use that factor now, and we could find that we could conclude, as I think we have concluded, that many of the factors are not constitutionally required. Consecutive sentencing, probably not constitutionally required now. Criminal history, certainly not constitutionally required. In fact, the Blakely decision and Apprendi say specifically that prior convictions are an exception. The latest case, the Shepherd case, is casting considerable doubt upon that, so it may be that we will have a constitutional requirement in 2 or 3 years that be proved to a jury, but this statute doesn't allow us perhaps to do that because right now it's not constitutionally required. So then we end up with cases in the next 2 or 3 years in which we've submitted those to judges because the statute says only the stuff that's constitutionally required needs to be submitted to a jury. We submit those to judges who make the decision, and upon reversal, if that happens, of that by the United States Supreme Court, all those cases in the system will then be subject to appeal. And so I don't think it's a major factor, but it's just a matter of allowing the flexibility, if we choose to submit these cases, to submit those enhancement factors to a jury. Again, I just don't think it's going to be a substantial issue because very few defendants are going to want to have it submitted to a jury and will most likely, as they have done throughout the state and other states that have a similar procedure, will waive their right to have that go to a jury anyway. But the issue basically is, should we allow the flexibility to submit questionable issues to the jury now, or should we just wait till there's an ultimate constitutional determination on that? Again, I think I understand Mr. Holman's position, and it certainly was one that was raised throughout the workgroup committee, but the protection of that, but the defendant always has the protection under this statute to waive his right to a jury determination on the issue. And having done that, the court would decide it the issue just like they've always decided that issue. So I think that what Ms. Lloyd has raised, and we just had a chance to start thinking about this a few hours ago, would effectively allow us to prevent a lot of cases being overturned, but would also protect the defendant's right to have sentencing exactly as he wants to have it, which is either before a court or before the jury.
Yeah, Senator Prusansky has a question, but I wanted to ask a quick one first. As you read this language, do you think this would preclude, for example, I could very easily see a district attorney in a trial court now deciding to use this process for consecutive sentences. It hasn't been adjudicated yet, but there's a case working its way through. And to be cautious, I could see the desire to do that. Do you think that this would prohibit you from doing that?
Well, I know that that would be the argument from the other side, that the statute only identifies an enhancement fact as that which is constitutionally required to be found. I think that the argument now is that consecutive sentencing is not constitutionally required. There's at least case law that in Oregon that leads us to believe, a case decided on November 16th of last year, that consecutive sentencing does not apply, Blakely does not apply to consecutive sentencing. So I would think that the argument from the defense, and were I a defense attorney, I certainly would make that argument, that the statute doesn't allow you to submit that to a jury. The judge has to decide the consecutive sentencing factors. A prosecutor might want to cover their bases then to say, look, let the jury decide that. If the defendant wants the jury to decide that, the defendant should be entitled to have the jury decide that. He can waive that if he wants to, but he should be entitled to have the jury decide that, and then we're safe. That case will not be reversed on appeal.
Mr. Holman, could you comment on that?
Well, I'd like to comment first on that. Well, it's related. The right to waive a jury trial doesn't exactly protect the accused's rights. I think that's a little stretching it a little bit. I see Mr. French's point, but I don't see that if we have a narrow list of aggravators, then we're going to know what we're looking at, and we're going to assume that those are constitutionally permissible. My concern is that if we tinker with this too much, we just stretch out a list of enhancement factors or aggravating factors that aren't going to be definite, that aren't going to be narrow.
But what if it was written broadly enough that, say, the prosecutor had and the court had the option to give the defendant the right to a jury trial in the case of consecutive sentences? What if it were written broadly enough?
I think what we've been arguing all along is that that is a Blakely issue, and that that's a matter that should be presented to the jury. We'd be changing our position, not that we haven't done that in the past, but we'd be changing our position to argue that it's not constitutionally required.
That's interesting, because
it's been litigated. I mean,
it's
coming
it
up.
It
hasn't been decided by the appellate courts yet. But, the issue is that it is a factor to impose a consecutive sentence on a crime that arises out of the same episode as the other crime. The court has to make additional findings, and our argument has been all along that those additional findings are findings that should be made by a jury under Blakely that are required to be.
So, but by that reasoning, then you'd say that enhancement fact means the fact that someone out there thinks is
constitutionally
required. So I can see where the problem is. Senator Prusansky, long-suffering waiting.
No suffering. It just seems to me the conservative approach here is to make certain that the defendant, he or she, has every right to make certain determinations, and such as on these enhancements. I mean, my counsel would be open it up, make certain that you have waiver, at least, from the defendant as to how he or she wants the sentencing part to go forward. I think what Mr. French has said is not unique, but would be worth looking at, and that is, I mean, to me, if you're you got first your jury trial for guilt. Once you get the guilt, then there's going to be the next part, and the defendant has to make a decision. Either the jury that just heard this case or the judge that was over presiding is going to make that determination as to what the sentence is going to be. And in that, what are those other factors that they want to consider? Because if you're going to potentially have these individuals going concurrent or consecutive, to me, I think there can be an argument that is an enhanced penalty because you're basically making that length of time. And so I would want to make certain that whatever we put in the statute is going to allow, and maybe not only allow, but require that be done. I anxiously wait to hear the judge's perspective from being on the bench for as long as he has as to how do we make certain that, I mean, no one needs to go through a second trial or retry. And the victims, the defendant, everyone, and so the quicker we can get this resolved and move on, I think is the best. And my caution and my preference would be to make it as broad as it can be, just take the conservative approach and not try to shave the edges and save time here or there, because it may come back to bite us financially as well as emotionally for all the people that are involved in these trials.
And Chair Burdick and Senator Prezansky and the members of the committee, the thing I think we want to get across here, though, is that we want ultimately, when the courts have decided all this 3 or 4 years from now, we want the bill to apply to those factors which are constitutionally required. I think that was everyone's intent. The point Ms. Lloyd is raising is that we want to have the flexibility until we know what those final decisions are by the courts to include, as a matter of conservative practice, to include other factors which I think the state might think are vulnerable to constitutional attack later on. I don't think what we want to do is write into the bill a lot of factors which ultimately will prove not to be constitutionally required, like consecutive sentencing. I think if a prosecutor wants to proceed to a jury on consecutive sentencing with the thought in the future that, well, maybe that might be constitutionally required, they should have that option. However, if we write it in that into the bill that consecutive sentencing is required to be pled and proved to a jury, we might just find, as I suspect we will find, that the Court of Appeals doesn't think that that's constitutionally required, and we don't want to extend it beyond the constitutional requirements and put that up, Blakely.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I mean, Mr. French, I agree with what you're saying, but we're looking at the state level. What if the feds, if the U.S. Supreme Court comes back and says that is a constitutional, I mean, have we not basically, even though the state says it's not, we're going to have to fall in line with what the feds tell us. And so I would want to make certain that, I mean, that's where a lot of this stuff is coming down. We as a state or other states have gone forward, and they thought what they've done is constitutional, only to find out at the federal level it's not.
Right.
And I'm not saying that we have to put in here that this is constitutionally protected. I just want to make sure that we put it in there in a way that we allow for that to occur, and we don't do it so narrowly that a judge says, in statute, you can't do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to just make certain that we have that broadness that is, in my opinion, more conservative approach for the whole system.
Senator Prezansky, I think that's what this does, as it's currently written, is it's a broad approach. What we're concerned with is just the narrow segment of cases for the next 2 or 3 years until we have a better understanding of what the appellate courts are going to do and what their constitutional boundaries are, is to allow us to expand the boundaries if we want to. I mean, we wouldn't have to if we as prosecutors would want to take the risk that, for instance, try the case to a jury and allow consecutive sentencing and prior convictions, allow that to be tried by a judge with the understanding that you may have to retry this sentencing later on down the line if it gets reversed. I think we ought to have the flexibility to do that. But I do think that your concern is addressed in the wording of the statute now. What I think we were considering here was just a fine-tuning of that to prevent the appellate division from having to try a number of cases or have to resolve a number of cases and have those retried for ones that are in the system now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, but one thing for sure is that you're not going to get in trouble constitutionally by putting too many things to a jury.
I mean, you will not get in trouble constitutionally.
Yes.
You might be unable to do that.
But that's
under the
whole
scheme.
Point that Senator
right.
Brzezinski yeah. is making. I agree with you. Need to have the flexibility to do that.
Right. And Mr. French, I mean, I really respect the position you're in. I know that you do felony work where I don't do that. But the reality, we have victims at the same time. I always try to make sure we get finality as quickly as we can. And you may, or your office, or someone else's office may say, we'll take that gamble. But there's a lot of other people who are impacted by that gamble. And so I'd rather just make sure that we do it and get it right. We can always come back and say, if the federal appellate courts come back and say, no, this isn't constitutional, if we want to ratchet it back, we could always do that at that time. So that's my two cents.
Yeah, I
think we're all in agreement here. And I, you know, again, I defer to, you know, the appellate division as to how the wording should look on that. But I think that it's a good idea to allow that flexibility.
Well, and to me, the litmus test should be, let's just take restitution, which I'm convinced will not be seen as a factor at the end of the day. I'd like it written broadly enough that if the decision was made that restitution should go to a jury, that the statutory authority to do that is there. And that's a good litmus test because it's pretty unlikely that that would happen. Well, who knows? You can never guess what the courts are going to do. But that would be a good litmus test, I think. Are there any other technical issues? I want to leave plenty of time for Judge Marcus. So.
Well, at Chair Burdick and members of the committee, at the risk of sucking all the air out of the room by continuing to raise little issues, just one quick thing. Subsection 2 is the Section 2, excuse me, is the provision that allows the allegation of enhancement facts in the charging instrument. There's a separate independent statute in Chapter 132. If I remember correctly, it's 132.560, but I can confirm that, or somebody else easily can, that expressly prohibits the state from alleging prior convictions in a charging instrument unless they are a material element of the offense. And so I believe that Section 2 would benefit from, we would all benefit from adding a notwithstanding clause to Section 2 that would say, notwithstanding the prohibitions in Chapter 132.560, either, I think it could fit just at the beginning of the section.
Wait a minute. Before you do that, the prior convictions were specifically exempted from Blakely. So if that's the only one that you're talking about, why would we need that?
Well, Chair Burdick and members of the committee, the Blakely and Apprendi and the cases before that have recognized or at least said that they're not extending the right to a jury trial to the fact of a prior conviction. So it appeared that there was an exception, and I think some of us are still hoping that there is. But in the most recent decision in United States versus Shepherd, the court signaled, I think very strongly, a number of people believe, signaled very strongly that exception may not be viable. And so given that we have this question, we also have in Oregon, our Court of Appeals has said that I'll back up because I'm not sure that really relates to the pleading requirement. I think, again, just because of the lack of certainty as to how far the right to a jury trial extends, it would not hurt anything to add a notwithstanding clause, and I think it would give the breadth, the same breadth that we've been talking about in some of these other provisions, for the state to play it safe, allege the facts. If the defendant doesn't want that proved to a jury, he or she has the right to waive a jury trial, but at least the state can give notice in the charging instrument of its intent to rely on prior convictions.
Counsel?
I just, members, wanted to, thank you, Madam Chair, I just wanted to give you the context. United States v. Shepard Supreme Court case from, I guess, several weeks ago now, in which, so federal case, Justice Scalia, I believe, wrote the majority opinion, as he did in United States v. Blakely, or excuse me, Blakely v. Washington. And the issue there was, I believe, the armed career criminal enhancement under the federal sentencing guidelines. And I think that the dispute in that case was whether or not the defendant's, federal defendant's prior conviction or convictions were considered a crime of violence under that armed career criminal enhancement. And built into that determination was some fact-finding that the judge had to make. So I think that I agree that there is an element of the prior conviction in that, and that and I know that there are definitely reasonable minds probably differ. There are a lot of lawyers who I think mean see that case as possibly an erosion of the Blakely exception that Chair Burdick pointed out, that we count any fact aside from a prior conviction that enhances the sentence as that which must be submitted and proved to a jury. So some people see that as an erosion. Others see that as kind of a unique circumstance that comes in this armed career criminal statute and what constitutes a violent felony.
And Senator Burdick and members of the committee, my only comment on that is that it would be advisable perhaps to have the change. It's not, I think, a major issue, simply because if we retain the structure that we have written here in 528-3, even if we couldn't plead it based on another statute, if we couldn't plead the priors, we can always give the defendant notice of it under subsection 2 of section 2. So while I think it's advisable to make the change that is recommended just because it provides complete symmetry here, it's something that we could do anyway with a notice requirement, or with it simply giving the defendant a notice of that issue, unless I'm missing something there.
No. I think that the concern is just that if a prosecutor were to look at this provision and say, okay, I'm allowed to plead things that I think I can use to enhance a sentence, it would be useful to make sure that person realizes that 132.560 exists and doesn't make that mistake. But I agree with Mr. French that it's not entirely necessary to make this work.
Well, and that was a good find on your part, if I may say so.
Chair Burdick, yeah. Members of the committee, not to belabor the point again, but persistent involvement is, I think, what we is offender-specific and not crime-specific, so it would be something that wouldn't go to the guilt phase jury anyway. It would go to the sentencing phase jury if we made those distinctions.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to ask this panel to stand by because we may be dragging you back up again. I want to give plenty of time to Judge Marcus, who is our next witness.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chair Burdick, members of the committee. I'm Michael Marcus. I've been a trial judge. I'm beginning my 16th year in Multnomah County. And I realize that I've been coming here for 30 years, not continuously, but here I am again. My primary interest about Blakely is that we do no harm in responding to it. It's been dogging my life since it was decided as what I view as basically an annoyance that we need to deal with so we can get back to the real problem, which is making sentencing serve public safety. And for me, none of this is about that. It's about getting the sentencing practice back into a place where it can work and do its business. I have not been attending the Blakely work group in part because I've been focused on the Governor's Public Safety Review Steering Committee process, which was parallel. Judge France from our court has been attending both groups, and I've been substituting for her at the Governor's work group on public safety review. The comments that I have about the Blakely bill, now Senate Bill 528-3, are relatively few. I expressed concerns to the work group, which I understand were finally addressed, whether or not because I expressed them last week, which resulted in this draft, concerning the difference between waiving the right to the jury to a jury on the issues that affect sentencing only, that is what the bill calls offense related, because I thought that it was important that there be separate waivers. And this solution seems to do that sufficiently. I was concerned about treating the remand cases because, unlike the great bulk of cases in which an offender is not going to want a jury to hear the aggravating factors that we usually speak of as enhancements, all the remand defendants have already gotten what they got from a judge. And they know what they got from a judge. Now they're going to want a jury trial, and this is a lump in the snake that we need to be equipped to deal with, and the language does that. Those are my primary concerns. This bill, when I saw on the agenda that you have two bills in work session, this bill kind of eclipses them. What I was going to suggest about those bills, which is now a problem in here, a technical problem, is that with respect to dangerous offenders and sexually violent dangerous offenders, both sections that deal with that speak about how the jury will get the pre-sentence investigation. At the same time, and within a few lines of saying the rules of evidence apply. And that's a direct problem, because the pre-sentence investigation is inherently hearsay. There are all sorts of problems with those going to a jury, and that's a technical issue that needs to be dealt with. I think it can be dealt with. Because no way can you have both things be so, get the PSI to the jury and apply the rules of evidence.
Do you have any ideas on how to address that?
One way is simply to take the reference to the PSI out, but I saw this bill, this amendment, even more recently than anybody else. I saw it on the table when I got here. I looked at the bills, which are 255 and 256, and I didn't know they were going to be up until I pulled the agenda this morning. So I haven't. I could propose some language. I think maybe merely removing the reference to the PSI would do it after considering the evidence.
No, I appreciate it. We do know that these things came out very late, and I want to let everybody off the hook. We're not going to come even close to moving anything today.
An issue which nags at me, and I've commented, and I'm not sure what the solution is, but at least let's make a record here. Under current law, if there is a piece of evidence that is offered by either side that the other side feels so fundamentally risks misguiding the jury to decide the case for the wrong reason, Evidence Code 403 presupposes provides that a judge will weigh the probative value, the legitimate use of the evidence, versus the potential that it will destroy the fairness of the case, in essence. That's what it means now. By distinguishing between offense-related and offender-related enhancement factors, we may be creating, in some cases, a real problem, because there may be offense-related factors that have nothing to do with guilt that might so tremendously prejudice the case as to lead a jury, because they're so outraged, to convict somebody who might be innocent because they're outraged at this offense-related enhancement outrage. Dismembering a corpse comes to mind. The madder the jury gets, the more inflamed the jury gets, it may not have anything to do with guilt. Gang-related activity, for another one. I'm concerned, and I'm just making the record. As you know, the Judicial Department has taken no position on this bill. I think that there is a sloppiness between offense-related and offender-related, and if anybody's interested in the fix, any other category which the judge determines as a constitutional matter must be tried separately than guilt, and then be pushed to the guilt, to the sentencing phase. That kind of catch-all would limit it to constitutional problems and give the judge a fix. I'm just raising that for the record. I think there's a real potential problem in a small number of cases. I did, when I was grimacing back there about comments, as to the need to deal with alerting the defense to enhancement factors for the first time on remand, My sense is that there are severe appellate restrictions on how the state can seek a greater sentence on remand than it sought in the first place. I think that's maybe not an empty set, but a very tiny one, and that's at least worth mentioning. But in general, the risk of appealing is not getting a greater sentence on remand. So in general, a remand will only be an occasion for the state to seek the same enhanced penalty as it got the first place. The defendant generally doesn't lose the value of whatever sentence the defendant got from the defendant's point of view by appealing and then getting reversed on other rooms. There are some exceptions.
Right, and I think the intent there, as I heard it, was the original sentence might not have passed muster on Blakely, so that you have to deal with it when it comes back on remand.
Right, and my point was that the concern was, do you have reasonable time, does the prosecution have reasonable time to give notice of the enhancement? And if it has to be after indictment, well, what happens if there's an intervening appeal? And my answer to that is, in almost all, maybe all cases, you don't get an enhancement unless you've tried to get one at the first time around, just because there's an appeal and a reversal on some other reason. My major point about the Blakely bill, and while everybody was going to a Denver conference, I went to a conference in August of the commissioners on state sentencing commissions in Santa Fe, New Mexico, at which Blakely was the new topic du jour, because the guidelines movement and its primary national promoter, Professor Kevin Wright's, through the Model Penal Code, was terribly disrupted by Blakely. Blakely was everywhere, and everybody was talking about Blakely. And I still wanted to get back to the point. And the point is that sentencing doesn't seek responsibly to achieve crime reduction, and nothing in the sentencing guidelines points the judge or the participants in the direction of crime reduction, except for maybe 3 out of 99 of the roadblocks. And therefore, when I heard there were discussions in the Blakely work group about an exclusive list of aggravating factors, I was greatly concerned that we not exclude crime reduction or preventing recidivism as a factor which might support an increased length of sentence, which seems to me to be so obvious as to be tautological, but believe it or not, it's not. It's a real issue. And I'll speak more about that on the two bills that I'm here to testify on. But those are my comments. At the moment, the bill does not have an exclusive list. I know that there are concerns from a variety of quarters that we don't want this open-ended, we don't want surprises. Defendants have a right to know what's coming at them. But everybody has a right to a sentencing system which has the ability to determine a sentence based on its public safety impact. And unless that's an available factor, we're not doing our job. So if any members have questions, I'd be happy to try to respond to them.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you for coming down. Is there any other thoughts that other members of the panel might have before we close this hearing? We will close the hearing on Senate Bill 528, and we will open a hearing on Senate Bill 9. Should we do this? Let's see. Should we do these together?
Okay. One is as to the pre-sentence investigation, and one is as to the criminal justice commission.
Yeah, I think we'll open the hearing on Senate Bill 914 and 919 together. Save a little time here. Judge Marcus, you are on. Oh, counsel, first of all, you will summarize these.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 914 is a bill that pertains to pre-sentence reports. Pre-sentence investigations are routinely ordered and may be ordered following conviction of any felony. And this bill would require the Department of Corrections to establish uniform pre-sentence report forms that require the writers of the reports to provide an analysis of the means to reduce future criminal behavior, and also to include a section concerning the availability of programs and treatment to the offender that are available both in and out of custody. There's a dash one amendment to this bill that is essentially a clarification of the original language. Senate Bill 919 is a bill with a similar principle, but it is directed toward the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, and it would require the CJC to conduct a study to determine whether it is possible to incorporate consideration of reducing criminal conduct and reducing the crime rate into this felony sentencing guidelines. The report that the CJC would prepare would need to be submitted to the next Legislative Assembly in 2007. The Dash 1 amendment clarifies that the CJC is to use its commission staff and resources to the greatest extent possible in conducting the study.
Thank you very much. Judge Marcus? And maybe Tim Sylvester, if he's still here, can come on up.
Members of the committee, just a little background. The governor convened a public safety...
Would you identify yourself?
I'm sorry, Judge Michael Marcus again, still in my beginning my 16th year as a Multnomah County circuit judge, or as a trial judge in Multnomah County. The evolution of the position is complicated and irrelevant. The governor convened, I think, late 2003 or early 2004, a public safety review steering committee, charged it with reviewing Oregon law to see whether Oregon criminal law adequately protected the safety of Oregon citizens, and if not, to make proposals as to how it might be changed. The committee, on which I was not an official member, but often served on behalf of Judge France, who was busy eventually going to Blakely meetings, I attended all of the meetings. The committee was broken into task forces dealing with a variety of topics, including adult sentencing, and it had a task force, a subcommittee on sentencing positions. So as a frequent, persistent, and regular attender of the Sentencing Position Subcommittee of the Adult Sentencing Task Force of the Public Safety Review Steering Committee, I made some proposals, and Senate Bills 914 and 919 are Legislative Council's renditions of the proposals as they passed the Steering Committee. They were adopted by all of the subgroups and passed the Steering Committee. Both bills address a problem. Both bills represent a pathetically modest attempt to solve the problem, but it's all I got, and I'm here today to urge their passage as amended by the proposed amendments, which, again, restore the bills as they were approved by the committee. Oregon law has long recited that one of the purposes of sentencing is to reduce recidivism, to protect the community from the behavior of the offender through rehabilitation or incapacitation. That principle goes back to the 1962 Model Penal Code, which Oregon adopted in 1971. The sentencing guidelines were passed in 1989. They have nothing intentionally to do with crime reduction. Let me just repeat that because it's so bizarre that I have trouble believing it even when I say it again. The sentencing guidelines that were passed in 1989 had nothing intentionally to do with crime reduction, except to the extent, a very minor extent, that three blocks dealing with optional probation say that if there is a treatment program which is more likely than the presumptive probation, presumptive prison, to result in a reduction in recidivism, then the judge can use it without a departure. The rest of the grid blocks don't speak of public safety at all. They are intended to quantify just deserts or accountability, and they are designed to impose prison time and post-prison time on some ordered distribution based on accountability or just deserts without reference to public safety whatsoever. Fortunately, the guidelines, by common sense, have a crude and generally correct notion that those who commit worse crimes with worse records ought to do more time. And that, in fact, is crudely related to risk assessment and, in fact, results crudely, imprecisely, in the longer incarceration of the more dangerous offenders. It does it with great imprecision and with great ineffectiveness. We have a tremendous recidivism rate as a result of sentencing which does not responsible to address crime reduction. We have a sentencing culture which talks about how mad we should be at the offender rather than how we can manage the risk that the offender represents. As a result of all of this, our recidivism rates are astronomical. The Department of Corrections will tell you that the recidivism rate is roughly around 30%. What they don't tell you, unless you push, is that they don't count misdemeanors as recidivism. If you look at real recidivism rates, they're actually in the neighborhood of 65% and up for most crimes. The result of all of this is that most offenders, I noticed this before I even got to the bench full-time as a pro tem, most offenders that I sentence have been sentenced before, and clearly those that have been sentenced before were not prevented by their prior sentences from committing their new acts. Most offenders I have sentenced for serious crimes have been sentenced for prior crimes, again, without preventing the new act. It's certainly not true that every sentencing opportunity is one in which we have a realistic hope of preventing the next crime. But it's as equally true and much more troublesome that we make no responsible effort in sentencing or our sentencing culture to use the discretion that judges have to reduce the criminal behavior of the offender. And that, in my view, is, well, diagnostically, is the reason for my obsession. And I can't ignore it. And in this context, that's why Blakely is just an annoyance. These two bills are two proposals out of six that were ultimately presented to the subcommittee. Four of those proposals were rejected. I think it's noteworthy to know what they were because it speaks to the culture of the sentencing world, the criminal justice community. The proposals were to make explicit what is already implicit in our law, that a judge can consider public safety in making such decisions as departure decisions for the guidelines, what to do with a probationer who's violated probation when the court finds a probation violation, whether to impose consecutive sentencing, and whether to treat a juvenile who's not covered by ballot measure 11 as an adult. All of these are discretionary decisions the court frequently makes. All of them are decisions in which public safety is a permissible consideration, and the proposals that were defeated were to add as permissible considerations within those statutes crime reduction, reduction of recidivism. And they were all defeated on such notions as including the language in the statute might have unforeseeable consequences, might extend the length of hearings. And I mention that not because I'm trying to gut and stuff bills, because I've got bills that I've got everybody on board on as far as I know. Listen, see. and Steve Dole,
in favor.
Steve Dole stopped by to say that with the amendment which restores the delicate balance that was achieved in committee and indelicately removed by legislative counsel to 919, I can explain the derivation. He's on board. Crime Victims United is on board with 919 and 914. What these two bills do is, first of all, Multnomah County has experimented with a pre-sentence investigation form for a couple of years. We have the typical pre-sentence investigation does a background check about the defendant. We use them very rarely, by the way, and this bill has no impact on how often we use PSIs. But when we do use a PSI, it's generally because we've got a dangerous offender of some sort. I don't mean technically dangerous. We have somebody who's serious, who's got a serious criminal history, and we're trying to figure out what best to do with them. And just to give you an example of how PSIs might play, I had two sentencings on the same day. One resulted in a 57-year sentence for an offender. This was based on consecutive sentencing of the sort that doesn't have a Blakely problem, with an offender who committed a series of sexual assaults on the same mentally ill or mentally challenged victim over a long period of time. And based on the pre-sentence investigation, I could see that we were dealing with somebody who was basically not susceptible to any program we know of to make him safe. At the same time, I had an offender who was an optional probation, who had a series of failures in treatment, and was up for a presumptive 13 months prison, and I was convinced by the PSI, I think it was by the same writer, to use optional probation because it was a program that I felt would make him less dangerous after we were through with him than prison would. What this hasn't had, what we haven't had in the PSI before, is the option to ask the pre-sentence investigator, who's actually trained in such things, to give us an assessment of which of our options is most likely to reduce crime, and to give us the information if any of those options include some program, and I don't just mean treatment, whatever it is, whether it's Forest Project, whether it's faith-based treatment, whether it's alternative community service, whether it's some form of supervision, whatever it is, what's most likely to work? How do you know that? Tell us why, so we can assess in our hearing. What's most, so we can spend some competent attention to what's most likely to work to reduce crime, which under the Constitution of the state is what we're supposed to be doing, but under the guidelines we never do. Multnomah County adopted that proposal by adding a box judges could check off in our form that requests a PSI, and this bill, which has the support of, among others, Department of Corrections, all the representatives of the steering committee, subcommittee, would simply have those PSIs which are written address the same thing statewide. I mean, that it's necessary to do this should be shocking to anybody. Why haven't they been doing it all along? I don't know, but this would be a modest step towards bringing that information to the table about making the critical decision. Because before this in Multnomah County, you have all that information, then you have a recommendation, and there's this big logical gap. Why does this recommendation flow from this information in a way that has anything to do with public safety? This would help. Senate Bill 919 is the modest attempt to explore the possibility that the sentencing guidelines might just have some role in encouraging the sentence which actually serves public safety. Again, in a sense, it's embarrassing to have to make that proposal, but I can tell you that the major author of the guidelines, Hardy Myers, was head of this task force, and he supports this, and he conceded that the guidelines have nothing to do with public safety. In fact, three grid blocks to some extent do, but nothing intentionally to do with public safety. There would be a committee formed. There is a statute which provides for that committee, and the bill recites that statute. It's an existing statute which authorizes the commission to appoint a committee with representatives of all the players in the criminal justice system. And let me see if I can... Line 19 says there's somewhere over the bill. It's the reference is to RS 137.658, which allows the chair of the commission to appoint a committee. This bill, which would call for a review of the guidelines to see if they might possibly be revised to serve public safety, requires the appointment of such a committee. So all the players would have an opportunity to be heard. The amendment replaces.
Judge Marcus?
Yes.
We have a little difficult problem here. We got a couple committee members who need to go. These bills seem like a really good idea. If we could just hear a couple comments from the others, we may actually get a chance to move them today.
Okay, let me just start by explaining why this amendment is critical. The Crime Victims United would not sign on to 919 without the reintroduction of the language of the LC removed, because the, as I understand it, Crime Victims United is concerned, let me put this as delicately and neutrally as possible, that if we get some outsider to give us advice, it will be liberally tinged.
Okay.
But with this amendment, Steve Dole and the Crime Victims United supports the bill. I know of no opposition.
Senator Whitsitt, do you have a question?
Mr. Burr, I do. Is there any likelihood that 914 would have a fiscal impact?
We discussed the fiscal impact. I know, as far as I know, no one has claimed that there's a fiscal impact. I know the courts have said their budget analysis is that there won't be any fiscal impact on the courts. My understanding is how this works is whatever limited resources would be available to pre-sentence investigations would simply be reordered, that the discussion will be about what's most likely to work instead of that other portion of the report where they do something very different, which is hold forth on
Multnomah County
has reported, the Department of Community Justice has reported that this bill would have no impact. Now, of course, Multnomah County is already doing it, but they certainly didn't claim that it cost them any money in doing it for 2 years.
Because there's nothing new required, no new process, no new form. It's just what you look at.
So is the current law, is the current process required of all courts, or would this add a procedure to some courts?
Chair Burdick, Senator Ritz. PSIs are rarely required by statute. When they're required in all courts. There are bills, there's at least one or two bills that are pending that would narrow the requirements of using PSIs. We used to have them all the time. We got 4 PSI writers in Multnomah County. We used to have 20. So they're very rare, actually. What this language would do would add to other counties what Montgomery County has been doing for 2 years successfully with no apparent fiscal impact.
But it wouldn't expand the requirement for a pre-sentence?
No. It has no bearing on the number of cases to which PSIs are required or permissible.
Okay, great. Thank you. Mr. Sylvester, do you have brief comments?
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Tim Sylvester, Department of Justice. I will be exceedingly brief. I'm here only to say that Hardy Myers supports these proposals.
Thank you. And Mr. Prinz is back in the audience. Would you like to come up and get briefly on the record, Mr. Prinz?
Very briefly.
Senator Pisanski is getting restless.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Craig Prinz. I support both these bills, and I agree with the fiscal that it does not require anything new from any PSI writers.
Thank you very much. Questions? Comments? Okay. This hearing is closed on Senate Bills 914 and 919. And we will open a work session on Senate Bill 914, which has a -1 amendment. Senator Scott.
Madam Chair, I move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 914.
Senator Starr has moved the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 914. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Starr?
Move. Senate Bill 914 has amended the Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 914 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objections? So ordered. Who would like to carry this? I'll carry this. Okay. it's my judge, don't you understand? Okay, we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 919. Senator Starr, this way.
I move -1 amendment to Senate Bill 919.
Senator Starr has moved the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 919. Is there discussion? There objections? So ordered. Senator Starr.
Move Senate Bill 919 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 919 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Is there discussion? Objections? So ordered. I'll carry that one too. Thank you for staying, Senator Barr.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Marcus, and everyone else here. This was a good day. Senate Judiciary is adjourned.